Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast to end all podcasts, the podcast of the gods, trying something new. How much does it throw you after hearing me say the same thing for 265 days in a row and then me saying something different? Does it, like, I wonder if anyone out there is getting their OCD triggered by that. It is the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. That's for you OCD people. You can rest easy now. I've said the catchphrase. We are up to book 12, chapter 6. In reaching Moscow, after her meeting with Rostov, Princess Mary had found her nephew there with his tutor, and a letter from Prince Andrew giving her instructions how to get to her aunt, Malvinstiva, at Varenz. That feeling, akin to temptation which had tormented her during her father's illness, since his death, and especially since her meeting with Rostov, was smothered by arrangements for the journey, anxiety about her brother, settling in a new house, meeting new people, and attending to her nephew's education. She was sad. Now, after a month passed in quiet surroundings, she felt more and more deeply the loss of her father, which was associated in her mind with the ruin of Russia. She was agitated and incessantly tortured by the thought of the dangers to which her brother, the only intimate person now remaining to her, was exposed. She was worried, too, about her nephew's education, for which she had always felt herself incompetent. But in the depths of her soul, she felt at peace. A peace rising from consciousness of having stifled those personal dreams and hopes that had been on the point of awakening within her and were related to her meeting with Rostov. The day after her party, the governor's wife came to see Malvinstiva and, after discussing her plan with the aunt, remarked that, though under present circumstances a formal betrothal was of course not to be thought of, all the same the young people might be brought together and could get to know one another. Malvinstiva expressed approval, and the governor's wife began to speak of Rostov in Mary's presence, praising him and telling how he had blushed when Princess Mary's name was mentioned. But Princess Mary experienced a painful rather than joyful feeling. Her mental tranquility was destroyed, and desires, doubts, self-reproach, and hopes reawoke. During the 2 days that elapsed before Rostov called, Princess Mary continually thought of how she ought to behave to him. First, she decided not to come to the drawing room when he called to see her aunt, that it would not be proper for her, in her deep mourning, to receive visitors. Then she thought, this would be rude, after what he had done for her. Then it occurred to her that her aunt and the governor's wife had intentions concerning herself and Rostov. Their looks and words at times seemed to confirm this supposition. Then she told herself that only she, with her sinful nature, could think this of them. They could not forget that, situated as she was, while still wearing deep mourning, such matchmaking would be an insult to her and to her father's memory. Assuming that she did go down to see him, Princess Mary imagined the words he would say to her, and what she would say to him. And these words sometimes seemed undeservedly cold, and then to mean too much. More than anything, she feared lest the confusion she felt might overwhelm her and betray her as soon as she saw him. But when on Sunday after church the footman announced in the drawing room that Count Rostov had called, the princess showed no confusion, only a slight blush suffused her cheeks and her eyes lit up with a new and radiant light. "You have met him, aunt," said she in a calm voice, unable to herself understand that she could be outwardly so calm and natural. When Rostov entered the room, the princess dropped her eyes for an instant, as if to give the visitor time to greet her aunt, and then, just as Nicholas turned to her, she raised her head and met his look with shining eyes. With a movement full of dignity and grace, she half rose with a smile of pleasure. held out her slender, delicate hand to him and began to speak in a voice in which, for the first time, new, deep, womanly notes vibrated. Mademoiselle Bourienne, who was in the drawing-room, looked at Princess Mary in bewildered surprise. Herself a consummate coquette, she could not have manoeuvred better on meeting a man she wished to attract. Either black is particularly becoming to her, or she really has greatly improved without my having noticed, and above all, what tact and grace, thought Mademoiselle Bourienne. Had Princess Mary been capable of reflection at that moment, she would have been more surprised that Mademoiselle Bourienne, at the change that had taken place in herself. From the moment she recognized that dear, loved face, a new life force took possession of her and compelled her to speak and act apart from her own will. From the time Rostov entered, her face became suddenly transformed. It was as if a light had been kindled in a carved and painted lantern, and the intricate, skillful artistic work on its sides, that previously seemed dark, coarse and meaningless, was suddenly shown up in unexpected and striking beauty. For the first time, all that pure, spiritual, inward travail through which she had lived appeared on the surface. All her inward labour, her dissatisfaction with herself, her sufferings, her strivings after goodness, her meekness, love, and self-sacrifice, all this now shone in those radiant eyes, in her delicate smile, and in every trait of her gentle face. Rostov saw all this as clearly as if he had known her his whole life. He felt that the being before him was quite different from and better than anyone he had met before, and above all better than himself. Their conversation was very simple and unimportant. They spoke of the war, and like everyone else, unconsciously exaggerated their sorrow about it. They spoke of their last meeting, Nicholas trying to change the subject. They talked of the governor's kind wife, of Nicholas's relations, and of Princess Mary's. She did not talk about her brother, diverting the conversation as soon as her aunt mentioned Andrew. Evidently she could speak of Russia's misfortunes with a certain artificiality, but her brother was too near her heart, and she neither could nor would speak lightly of him. Nicholas noticed this, as he noticed every shade of Princess Mary's character, with an observation unusual to him, and everything confirmed his conviction that she was a quite unusual and extraordinary being. Nicholas blushed and was confused when people spoke to him about the princess, as she did when he was mentioned, and even when he thought of her. But in her presence he felt quite at ease, and said not at all what he had prepared, but what quite appropriately occurred to him at the moment. When a pause occurred during his short visit, Nicholas, as is usual when there are children, turned to Prince Andrew's little son, caressing him and asking whether he would like to be an hussar. He took the boy on his knee, played with him, and looked round at Princess Mary. With a softened, happy and timid look, she watched the boy she loved in the arms of the man she loved. Nicholas also noticed that look and, as if understanding it, flushed with pleasure and began to kiss the boy with good-natured playfulness. As she was in mourning, Princess Mary did not go out into society, and Nicholas did not think it the proper thing to visit her again. But all the same, the governor's wife went on with her matchmaking, passing on to Nicholas the flattering things Princess Mary said of him, and vice versa, and insisting on his declaring himself to Princess Mary. For this purpose she arranged a meeting between the young people at the bishop's house before Mass. Though Rostov told the governor's wife that he would not make any declaration to Princess Mary, he promised to go. As at Tilsit, Rostov had not allowed himself to doubt that what everybody considered right was right. So now, after a short but sincere struggle between his effort to arrange his life by his own sense of justice and an obedient submission to circumstances, he chose the latter and yielded to the power he felt irresistibly carrying him, he knew not where. He knew that after his promise to Sonya, it would be what he deemed base to declare his feelings to Princess Mary, and he knew that he would never act basely. But he also knew, or rather felt at the bottom of his heart, that by resigning himself now to the force of circumstances and to those who were guiding him, he was not only doing nothing wrong, but was doing something very, very important, more important than anything he had ever done in his life. After meeting Princess Mary, though the course of his life went on externally as before, all his former amusements lost their charm for him, and he often thought about her. But he never thought about her as he had thought of all the young ladies without exception whom he had met in society, nor as he had for a long time, and at one time rapturously, thought about Sonya. He had pictured each of those young ladies as almost all honest-hearted young men do, that is, as a possible wife, adapting her in his imagination to all the conditions of married life, a white dressing gown, his wife at the tea table, his wife's carriage, little ones, Mama and Papa, their relations to her, and so on. And these pictures of the future had given him pleasure. But with Princess Mary, to whom they were trying to get him engaged, he could never picture anything of future married life. If he tried, his pictures seemed incongruous and false. It made him afraid. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. That went quick, didn't it? That matchmaking. Boom, they're in the same room together. And bashful. Bashfully trying to make this conversation. They seem to do all right. And other than the very end of that chapter where he said he was afraid and couldn't picture a future together, I get the feeling that they're both very excited to see where this thing goes. And do you want to know what else? I think out of all the potential relationships or the actual relationships in this book so far, this one is the most exciting to me. It's the one I most want to see happen. They're a good match. I really like Maya, and I've wanted her to find a good husband, a good man, for the whole book. For the whole book, I've been on Team Maya. And I think Nicholas is a good guy. He's been a bit immature at times. We've seen him grow into a man. We've seen him become less immature, more mature, I suppose you could say. Overall, I think he's a good dude. Chattelvalster said, during Maya's meeting with Nikolai, Mademoiselle Borin thinks she couldn't have maneuvered better than Maya had during the meeting. Even though it's subconscious, would she have been able to pull off the same if her father was still alive? That's a good question. So Chattelvalster's sort of saying that all this mystique and depth and the fact that she was wearing dark clothes and everything that made her so alluring was the product of her mourning, but it was kind of sexy, I suppose, for want of a different word. Nikolai saw, ooh, dark, mysterious, brooding, deep, thoughtful person with those eyes. We've often heard about Maya's eyes having such depth and expressing all those things at once. He thought she was a better person than he was. Jen, what up? Said, I don't think that Princess Mary could have pulled it off if her father were alive. She would have been consumed with worry about him and his perception of her. Very good point. She does seem a lot freer now, doesn't she, since her father's died. As awful as that is to say, he was definitely holding her back, wasn't he? You can't really deny it. They had their weird relationship. He loved her in his very weird and almost cruel way. But now she's free of him and for the better. Chattelvalster also said, Nikolai isn't able to think of Maya in the context of their potential married life. Is this a good or bad sign? Jen, what up, also responded to this question saying, I think it's a good thing. It gives a sense of hope and excitement. Well, that's good that you're optimistic. I actually thought it was a bad sign. I thought he was thinking, like, he was looking at her and saying, wow, I'm so into her, but I just can't see it happening. I can't see this working out. You know, when there's no visible path forward, or like you can't picture the future or picture the place you want to go, it is difficult to manifest that thing. So that was my worry. But Jen, what up? I like your response. I like that a lot more. I really want this to happen for Maya and Nikolai. I'm excited. Caucus Tree said, upvote this to pity Sonia. And that has 10 upvotes, 10 people. And actually, I'm going to click it. Yep, it's 11 now. I do pity Sonia. Upvote received. A little bit. I pity her a little bit, but she's got a good head on her shoulders. We've seen that. I know she'll be upset. I know that. And I know she'll be, maybe depressed, devastated. But I do think in the long run she will be fine. I don't think it's going to destroy her future. I don't think it's going to have a negative impact on her long-term future. At least I hope not. All right, that's going to do us for the analysis of this chapter. Pretty cool little chapter. I like makes me feel like a teenager. Two people who were being like match made together, and the awkwardness and all that kind of stuff. I like that. Makes me feel young again. Hey, I wanted to say to you guys, I'm really excited at the moment because last night I had a meeting with the parents of one of my students who I teach creative writing. And this is aside, this is not a War and Peace thing, this is more a personal life thing. So I don't know if you guys know, I'll tell you briefly about this. I run a creative writing club. So a few years ago, in 2015, I went to the very first school who did my creative writing program, and I met a kid. He was in grade 6 named Aaron, and Aaron was working on a novel, and he participated in this program, and we made a book with the whole school, and then we had a little book launch party, and on their book launch party, they had a dress-up theme because it was part of their school fair. And the theme was dress up as what you want to be in the future. And he came dressed up in a top hat. I've got a photo of this. Top hat and a mustache and a pipe. And that was his author costume. He wanted to be an author when he grew up. And that was what he thought authors dressed as, I suppose. Anyway, back then I read his novel he was working on and was blown away. It was insanely good. Like, I work with a lot of grown-up writers as well. People who have written, you know, they're working on their third and fourth and fifth novel and aren't as good as this grade 6 kid was. I was amazed. A few years later, last year, I started an after-school writers club. I expanded my business. So before that, I just did school programs. I expanded it out to have an after-school special interest group for kids who wanted to be writers. He signed up. And every week he would come and we'd go on the whiteboard and flesh out our plots, and we'd have little planning sessions and figure out these short stories he wanted to write. And he was writing Doctor Who episodes, which were really, really good. And he was trying to think of, oh, what am I going to do with this idea for a novel? I want to write a novel. He kept saying he wanted to write a novel, but he couldn't land on an idea. He had too many ideas, really. Anyway, at the start of this year, that after school group ended. We stopped doing that. It was fun while it lasted, sort of thing, and I'm going to do that again in the future, but it's on pause. So I didn't see him for a few months, and then just a couple of months ago, he emailed me saying, hey, finish my first novel. I wanted you to be the first person to see it. He's in year 9 now, I believe. 9 or, yeah, he's 15 now. Finished his first novel at 15. Sends a copy of it to me, and oh my God, it's so good. It's a murder mystery. It's funny. It's very like, he's got a very British humor, sense of humor. So if you like Douglas Adams, like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if you like Doctor Who, if you like Terry Pratchett, that kind of comedy, Monty Python, silly kind of British humor. That's very much his style of humor. And he's written this sci-fi murder mystery. So it's about a murder that happens on this planet, which is dedicated to Like, it's basically like a giant retirement home for the rich, and a murder happens. And yeah, it's more murder mystery than sci-fi, but it's got different species and stuff on it. But it's good. It's really, really good. I was blown away. It's really, really funny too. I read it between two Terry Pratchett books. I read Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett, and then I read his book, and then I read Night Watch by Terry Pratchett. And it stood up in terms of entertainment, comedy. I enjoyed it just as much as the two Terry Pratchett books either side of it. So that's pretty high praise, especially Terry Pratchett's one of my favorite authors. Anyway, so that's Launchpad is the name of that after school program. My creative writing club is called Launchpad, and it's for kids who want to be writers, essentially. I also run an indie publishing label, and the point of that indie publishing label is that I've published anthologies of short stories by indie authors. And the whole thing is it's meant to be like an indie punk rock label. And people have said, why don't you publish people's novels through your indie publishing label? And the answer is I can't really do anything for them that they couldn't do themselves in terms of marketing, in terms of PR and, you know, getting the book reviewed and that kind of thing. I just didn't really want to go down that road yet. I always knew I would. I'm like, I'm looking for the first novel that will be an up-and-up media novel, but I just don't quite know what it is yet. It has to kind of mix into the whole thing that I'm doing in a way. I kind of thought, I'll know it when I see it, but it has to be more than just someone saying, like, hey, can you publish my novel? And I'll have a go, oh, yeah, it's pretty good, sure, why not? So I just thought, well, if I publish Aaron's novel, if that's the first Up and Up Media novel, it goes full circle. So he was in the very first Launchpad school in 2015, at the very start of this whole thing. And then he was one of the very first members of the after school program. And then it's almost like he's graduated from that, and now he's one of my indie writers. He's the first Up and Up Media writer, you know, in amongst all these other authors who are in my compilation books, my anthology books. Is this making sense? Sorry, this is a very long-winded thing. You've probably turned off the podcast by now. You can probably tell I'm excited, though. Anyway, so it just was like this light switch, like, oh, that's the book I've been waiting for. Like, it makes so much sense. He is like the full circle of everything I'm trying to do across both Launchpad and Up and Up Media. He connects everything all together. And not only that, it's actually a really, really good book. I spoke to his parents about it, and yeah, they're all really excited. I'm really excited. So he is going to be the first novelist under Up and Up Media. At the same time as that, I'm going to release a small catalogue of books, the first offering from Up and Up Media. One will be a novel, that will be Aaron's novel. One will be an anthology of short stories, which is Best of Launchpad. So with Launchpad, my school program, I've now worked with 1,600 kids, and each one of them has written a short story for Launchpad. Those stories aren't publicly available, they're for the schools, but I've always wanted to grab 30 of them, or 40 of them, or 50 of them, and release a book publicly, which is Favorites, Launchpad Favorites. It's not quite Best of, because it's not the best of those stories. It's like a really good mix of stories that shows the variety of different kinds of stories I get, and are also really entertaining. Some really funny ones, some really silly ones, some really spooky, some good mysteries, some good fantasy, good sci-fi, everything. But it's also, they're handpicked to be stories that are amusing. So I've even knocked back a few stories which are like, those are really well written, but they don't give you a chuckle, they don't give you a smile, they don't make you go, oh, that's interesting. So I knocked them back, because I want the book to be, flick to any page, find a short story, it should put a smile on your face. That's one of the other books on the catalogue. So I've got Aaron's novel, which is called Live a Little. I've got Launchpad Favourites. I've got Mixtape, the next mixtape book. Mixtapes are our indie author anthology books. So that's like the staple of Up and Up Media. That's our bread and butter, the mixtape anthology. So this will be mixtape 2. I have, and I've got a few other ideas. I want there to be 4, 5, maybe 6 books on this first catalogue of books that I'm going to release under Up and Up Media. I'm playing with the idea of putting one of my older novels on that catalogue, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I should. It just seems a bit off, doesn't it, to put your own book under your own publishing label. Is that weird? It would be weird to do that, wouldn't it? Anyway, that's not important. That's whether or not my book goes on there. I suppose I'll float it with people and see what reaction I get, and just think about it when it comes around. On the one hand, I want there to be more books on the catalogue, but on the other hand, I'm always like hyper sensitive, hyper aware of, like, I don't want to come across as like self-publishing label. I want it to be like, no, we publish good stuff, hand-picked, well-written, well-made stuff. It's not vanity publishing, as they call it. But then if you put your own novel through it, it does seem a bit vanity publishing-ish. Oh, I'm so conflicted on that last point, but anyway, that's for me to figure out. The most important thing is Aaron's novel, Live a Little, is going to be my first novel I publish through my publishing label, and I am super psyched. I was wondering if you guys would want to hear from Aaron through this podcast. I could do like a bonus episode where I invite him in to my studio, put a microphone in front of him and say, hey, Aaron, tell us how you wrote this book, or tell us about it, or, you know, something like that. So, I don't know, leave a comment, see what you think of that idea. I know that the audience of this podcast is a little divided between people who are interested in just War and Peace, and then there's also the people who are interested in me as an author and as a publisher. So, I'm just curious to see what everyone thinks. I suppose it's, you know, if you're not interested, you'll see that bonus in episode and just skip that one. But yeah, cool. All right, I'm blabbering on now. That's the end of this episode. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.